I'm going to read from Bhagavad Gita as it is, about dharma and adharma. It's just a very short purport, so you don't need the Croatian edition. This is Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 18, text 32. Adharmam dharmam iti ya manyate tamasavrita sarvartan viparitans cha buddhi sa partha tamasi. Translation. That understanding which considers irreligion to be religion and religion to be irreligion under the spell of illusion and darkness, and strives always in the wrong direction, O Partha, is in the mode of ignorance. Purport. Intelligence in the mode of ignorance is always working the opposite of the way it should. It accepts religions which are not actually religions and rejects actual religion. Men in ignorance understand a great soul to be a common man and accept a common man as a great soul. They think truth to be untruth and accept untruth as truth. In all activities, they simply take the wrong path. Therefore, their intelligence is in the mode of ignorance. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnanan Jana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yatapada Kamalam Shri Guru Navaishnavangscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shivashakan Vitamscha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yeah, my seminar was supposed to be on Dharma, but I was originally planning to discuss some of the intricacies of Dharma. But then devotees were telling me, well, they want a regular class. Anyway, this class will serve both purposes because it's a regular class on Bhagavad Gita and also discussing dharma and adharma. Another point I was thinking is that discussing the intricacies of dharma or the intricacies of anything else is... not of anything else, but anything else in relationship with Krishna consciousness, is valuable, but it may be more appropriate to discuss topics at a very basic level, instead of presuming that everyone's on the postgraduate status. And even if we are on the postgraduate status, it's also good to hear basic principles or the basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness. There's a lot in it. Just like here we're discussing Bhagavad Gita. There's a lot in Bhagavad Gita. I don't think any of us can say that I don't think anyone at anyone of any religious or intellectual standing can say that they've understood they've entered fully into the depths of Bhagavad Gita. There's so much there. That's Krishna speaking. When Krishna speaks, he's an expert speaker. So so much. It's not just information that Krishna is giving us in Bhagavad Gita, but it's not just information, but Krishna is giving us keys to transcendental understanding. Here, Krishna is discussing dharma and adharma, and Prabhupada has translated this as religion and irreligion, although elsewhere Prabhupada has stated, and it's not only Prabhupada that states this, but any scholar of, for want of a better word, Indian philosophy, for want of a better term, it's a general term, any scholar of Indian philosophy will also say that there's no actual translation of dharma that fully that can be fully described in English, because the very concept doesn't exist in the Western psyche. And it's interesting that even among acharyas or followers of the Vedic line, they also find it difficult to define dharma. As is stated in Shastra, what is that? Sukshma hi gatir dharma. The ways of dharma are very subtle. So it may be very difficult to understand exactly what is dharma. We find in Mahabharata so many different narrations of events that actually took place. But a repeated theme, dharma, if we take dharma to be religion or a way of life or righteousness or ultimate principle, the Prabhupada gave the definition that it's coming from the root, dhri, or dhru, that which sustains. So dharma is that which sustains existence at the most subtle level. That doesn't mean the ether in which the universe exists, but the very ultimate substance of the universe. So adherence to dharma, that sustains and nourishes our existence. So we find in Mahabharata so many stories of how people acted according to dharma or not according to dharma and the results they obtained. It's often very complex. Dharma, if we consider, what is the proper way to act? Because life is complex. Dharma is how to act, that is based on principles given in Shastra. Or not only principles, but rules given in Shastra. But life is very complex, and often the rules come into conflict with each other. Just like that well-known story, which I've told maybe 100 times, this may be 101, but it's very illustrative that Krishna told this story. We find in Mahabharata that there was a brahmana who had vowed never to tell a lie throughout his whole life. He lived at the edge of a village, just next to the forest. One day, a man came running past his house and said, some men are chasing me to rob me. Where can I hide? So the brahmana directed, just hide in that forest over there. Then a few minutes later, some other men came running up and said, we're robbers, we're chasing after a man who's carrying a lot of money. Do you know where he is? And the brahmana said, yes. Where is he? He's over there in that forest. So they went there, killed him, and took all his money. And the brahmana never told a lie in his life. He didn't lie to the robbers. He told them the truth. When he died, he went to hell. He never told a lie in his life. He went to hell because in that situation, he should have told a lie. Because the principle of protecting a person who did not deserve to be killed, that was more important than the principle of not telling a lie and the other principle of maintaining his vow. He should have broken his vow. He should have told a lie to protect a person. We find even Shukracharya trying to convince, in Bhagavatam, we find Shukracharya trying to convince Bali Maharaj to tell a falsehood, that Bali Maharaj promised to give Vamandev 3 steps of land. And Shukracharya quotes from Shastra that there's nothing wrong to tell a lie, and he gives various instances. Then to save a life, to in seducing a woman, that's one of the things. then to maintain the principle. There are various, Shastra gives various instances when it's actually not sinful to tell a lie, and that actually one should tell a lie. So anyway, this shows that the ways of dharma are very subtle and difficult to understand. However, I was saying that even in the Vedic line, different acharyas, they find it difficult to exactly define what dharma is. But those who know the absolute truth, they know what dharma is. Dharma is actually a name for Vishnu. That which sustains the universe, ultimately that's Vishnu. And dharma, dharmang tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Dharma means that which is given in the Shastra by Bhagavan. Navai vidu rishiyo napi devaha. Neither rishis nor devas and vidyadharas, charanas, no one else but the Supreme Lord can define what is dharma. So the Supreme Lord defines dharma in Shastra, and he personally comes and teaches dharma, and he sends his representatives. Therefore, Yudhishthira Maharaj, when replying in Mahabharata to the Yaksha, there's a famous section in the Mahabharata called Yaksha Prashna. The Yaksha, who was none other than Yamaraj, the father of Yudhishthira Maharaj, they were both called Dharmaraj, kings who were the embodiment of dharma. So the Yamaraj, taking the form of a yaksha, asked Yudhishthira so many questions. So then one question was that, how can we ascertain dharma? Very difficult question. Very tough question. This question is, this one has stumped. You know the term stumped? It means that when you're asking questions, someone giving an answer like a quiz, something like, and all of a sudden, boom, you can't say anything, nothing more to say. You're lost. You can't give an answer. So this, Hare Krishna, the system got stumped. It reacted. So something like that. This question has stumped many great knowers of religion or many great philosophers. But Yudhishthira Maharaj, he gave the answer that how is dharma to be understood? Tarko prachishta shutayo vibhinna nasav rishe yasya matang nabhinnam. Mahajana, what is the next line? Dharmasya tatvang nihitam guhayam mahajano yena gata sapanta. He says that not by argument can dharma be ascertained. And even the scriptures say different things. Different scriptures give different opinions, or apparently different opinions. And if you ask different rishis, they'll all say different things. Therefore, the truth of dharma, that can be found in the heart of a self-realized person, Mahajana. Therefore, one should follow the path of Mahajan, or a great self-realized person. And then comes the question, who is a Mahajan? How can we recognize a Mahajan? And Prabhupada, in commenting on this verse, which appears, is quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he gives a wonderful purport, saying that, well, to the demons, Hiranyakashipu is a Mahajan. They follow his path. To the Rakshasas, Ravana is a Mahajan. They follow his path. To scientists, persons like Einstein, they consider him a Mahajan. But as far as the devotees are concerned, Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Kumara, Kapilo, Manu, Prahalado, Janako, Bhishmas, Balaya, Vyasakiya, Vayam. Yamaraj, again, Dharmaraj, says that there are 12 Mahajans whose names were just given, that Brahma, Shiva, Narad, Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Kumara, the four Kumaras, Sanat Kumara and his brothers, Kumara, Kapila, the Supreme Lord who is acting as a devotee, Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, Prahlad Maharaj, Prahlado Janak Maharaj, who was the father of Sita Devi, Bhishma, Prahlado Janaka, and Bali Maharaj, Shukadev Goswami, and myself, Yamar. And there are actually many other, just like Prabhupada, he's a Mahajan, Tattvadarshi, one who knows the truth. So the question, exactly how to ascertain it, it becomes a little, not a little, it's not actually ascertainable by a totally empiric method, or even by a totally scriptural method. One has to exercise some judgment based upon his own heart also. That sounds very dangerous. It is, because our hearts are contaminated. But it requires then some sincerity to actually want to be purified, to want to understand what is the essence of dharma. And if one has that desire, then Brahmanda Brahmite Kono Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. That if one is sincere, out of all the millions of living beings wandering around the universe in 8,400,000 species of life, one fortunate person, by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, and what that fortune is, that's also not just chance, that depends on one's sincerity also. He will, by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, get the seed of the creeper which grows into the seed of the creeper of devotional service. So that is param dharma. Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhakti aradhokshaje ahaituki apratihataya yatma supracedati. This is the perfection of religious understanding. What is the topmost? There's another translation or understanding of dharma. Dharma means duty. That is sometimes translated as duty, religious duty. So what is our topmost duty? The topmost duty of every living being is, as described in Srimad Bhagavatam, to render devotional service to the transcendent Lord. Such service must be uninterrupted and unmotivated and uninterrupted. That only can fully satisfy the self. So this is the perfect and scientific definition of dharma. What is the ultimate manifestation of dharma? Service to the selfless, unceasing devotional service to the Supreme Lord, who is not part of this material world, the transcendent Lord. Now, what goes on in the name of dharma in this world, just like again, Mahabharata, Ramayana, this is described, what is righteousness? Much of that is it's righteousness, it's good, but it is what, to a large extent, it is what nowadays we would call morality. Religious morality. Modern morality tends to be humanistic. That we just be good, be nice to others, but with no transcendental understanding behind it, no understanding that, well, ultimate morality is to follow the laws of God for the sake of pleasing Him. So this worldly morality in relationship with God, that mostly goes on the platform of thinking, I should be good, and then God will reward me, and I can go to the heavenly planets. Or I should be good, and God, the undefinable God, and we don't want to define Him also, the impersonalists' outlook. God, we cannot define Him, and don't define Him. He should not be defined. The impersonalist outlook, that God is there, some kind of nebulous entity. And if we follow the rules of dharma, then we can become liberated and we can merge into God. So this is a worldly outlook on dharma. And Krishna, practically, I mean, it may sound strange to say it, but it seems like he humiliated Yudhishthira Maharaj by Actually, for a devotee to be humiliated by the Supreme Lord, is a great mercy. Like Bali Maharaj, he was humiliated by Krishna, by Vamanadeva. Lord Shiva was humiliated in front of his wife, in front of all the rishis who were worshipping him. He ran after Mohini Murti. But afterwards he felt, oh, actually this is very nice. Because it is seen that Lord Vishnu's potency is such that he can even bewilder me. So Lord Krishna also apparently humiliated Yudhishthira Maharaj in the incident where it was known because before the battle began, Yudhishthira Maharaj, following all the rules of Dharma, went up to the leaders, his gurus on the other camp, on the camp of the Kauravas. His gurus, that means his superiors. Dronacharya was directly his guru. They taught the science of fighting. There was also Bhishma Dev, who was guru, being Pitamaha, his grandfather, on the status of his grandfather. Then Ashvatthama, who, although more or less the same age as the Pandavas, was considered a guru because he was Brahmin, at least by caste. Then who else was there? Kripa and Shalva. These were all superiors in terms of age and social status to Yudhishthira. So he went up to them all, and before you begin any great endeavor, one should ask the blessings of one's superiors. So he went up to all the gurus and asked them, please give me blessings so that I can fight you. They all said, yes, okay. And I would like to know, he asked each of them individually, please tell me, because you're all very great fighters, how can I kill you? How may you be killed? Because we're here to fight you, and you're our gurus, and you always give us advice on everything. So we're here to fight you and kill you, so please give us advice on how we can kill you. So there were various replies. Ashvatthama said, you can't, forget it. I'm going to be alive at the end of this battle. And he was. He still is, by the way. He's meditating somewhere up in the Himalayas. And Dronacharya said that... Well, actually, first of all, he asked Dronacharya, he said, how can you be killed? And Drona said, well, I can only be killed. None of you. You can't kill me. But I could only be killed if my son Ashvatthama is killed. And then out of disappointment, I would lose any desire to fight and I could be killed. Then he went to Ashvatthama, give blessings. Okay, blessings. Then how can you be killed? I can't be. I'm not going to be killed. I'm still going to be here. So then there came, after Bhishma Dev was removed from the fight, he was lying on his bed of arrows, incapacitated. So then Drona took charge of the Kaurava's army. And he was fighting so severely that it appeared within one day the whole of the Pandava's army would be finished. So Krishna thought, well, we got to do something about that. We got to stop him. How to stop him? Only if Ashvatthama is killed. How can Ashvatthama be killed? He can't be killed. It's an impossible situation. In this situation, it requires God to give a solution. So God gave the solution. So he told that we shall have to declare, we shall have to tell Drona that Ashvatthama is dead. But it's no use me telling. He won't believe me. I'm known as a politician and a liar and all these things. So he told Yudhishthira Maharaj, you declare in the presence of Drona, declare loudly, Ashvatthama is killed. And Yudhishthira said, I never told a lie in my life. I'm famous for not telling a lie. How can I do it? To my guru and mislead him? Then Krishna thought, okay, there's an elephant in our... It's a famous story. There's an elephant in our army called Ashvatthama also. So we'll kill him. And then you shout out, Ashvatthama. At that time, we'll blow the conches and we'll say, the elephant. And then when the conch stops blowing, you'll say, is dead. So they did like that. They did it. And Drona became disappointed and then he was killed. through the agency, actually Dhrishtadyumna, who was born to kill him. So what happened, you see, Yudhishthira Maharaj, his chariot used to go above the ground because he was so pious and so religious. He used to, somehow or other, used to go just above the ground. The wheels wouldn't touch the ground, just to show what a pure king he was. After this incident, the wheels came down. So generally this is interpreted that because he told a lie, he broke the principles of Dharma. Therefore, he lost that facility. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explained that because he hesitated to follow the order of Krishna and he put some condition on following Krishna's order, therefore it came down. He broke the principle of Dharma not by telling a lie. Not by telling a lie, but by hesitating to tell a lie on the order of Krishna. He was attached to worldly morality more than he was attached to following the order of Krishna. And he thought that what Krishna is telling me is immoral. How can I follow? I know Dharma better than Krishna. That's the implied message. So what Krishna wants, what Krishna ordains, that is the ultimate Dharma. But most followers of the Vedic culture, even their strict followers of Dharma, they can't understand that because they don't have knowledge of Krishna. And specifically this verse we read just now, adharmam dharmam itiya manyate tamasavrita. Persons who are in the mode of ignorance, because they don't understand what dharma is, they take that which is adharma to be dharma. What is, Prabhupada has translated here, what is irreligion to be religion, and what is religion to be irreligion. Which actually, in the Western countries, this is the most, I mean, who am I to comment, but it's the most appropriate translation, because there's no sense of dharma at all in the Western countries anyway. So dharma can also be translated as religion, although it's not a full translation. And even the word religion, what is called religion in the Western countries, because not only in the Western countries, all over the world, what goes on in the modern world in the name of religion? It's what people consider to be religion. It's not Bhagavad Dharma, which is actual dharma, actual religion, which means to act according to the order and desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur paraphrased a statement from the second verse of Srimad Bhagavatam that Pritivite Jato Kata Dharma Nama Chale Bhagavata Kahitaha Paripurna Chale. He said that whatever is going on in the name of religion in this world, according to the verdict of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's all cheating. Chal means cheating, cheating in the sense of trickery, trying to playing a trick on you, to try and cheat you. Swindle, swizzle, swindle. You know what that word means, swindle? It's something like cheating, especially in money matters. So, and swizzle, I guess, it's a kind of slang form of swindle. Makes it sound more real. So, what is going on in the name of religion is mostly irreligion. And I mean, I shouldn't say it. Now, is this dharma or adharma? Anyway, sometimes I find it a little humorous when I hear that our devotees are going to have a ISKCON registered as a bona fide religion. Because it's like getting a certificate from these people who are, you know, what they... That means they consider that now we've become, you know, like all the bona fide religions, they're all promoting beef eating, and a part of the church services, you have to drink a glass of wine. And I mean, it's so far away from anything that's real religion. And we're very excited now, we're getting a certificate that we're a bona fide religion from these people who've got no idea. Well, we're supposed to, if we would give them a certificate, that would be good for them. But for us to take a certificate from them, it's, you know, it's just science seems like ironic to me. The many years ago, as I was preaching, I guess you could call it, in Bangladesh, and there was a famous bogus guru there. I mean, one of the famous bogus gurus. So we happened to meet him. It was Vaishnav, of course. I mean, that means Vaishnav in Bangladesh generally means a bogus Vaishnav, upper sampradaya. So we happened to meet him, and he wasn't very happy to see us. And he immediately attacked us. Attack means, I mean, he didn't have machine guns, but verbally. He said that he didn't, philosophically, he didn't take up anything else with us, but he said in a rather agitated tone that, why are you preaching here? You go to the Western countries where they don't know about bhakti. Here the people know. It's, you know, it's my field here. So we said that, yes, people here, they know about bhakti, but not pure bhakti. They're all eating fish and all these different things. So we didn't come to a harmonious conclusion. He met us, he was angry, and he left angry. Anyway, many people used to say about him to us that, you see, he's a very great preacher of religion. He's a very, very authorized, because in his youth, he went to America and he got a PhD from the University of Chicago, as they say in India, because it's spelt like that, the University of Chicago, and he got a PhD in religion. And that shows, you see, that he's very authorized. And we would laugh and we'd say, he's getting a PhD in religion from these beef eaters and drunkards. And you take that as a qualification to teach religion, rather we'd consider that a disqualification. he had to get a stamp of authorization from these people. So, anyway, we could elaborate on this in many ways. People, to put it briefly, people are very confused as to what is actually religion. And just like if we see, now Sundan said we shouldn't criticize and we should try to find points of similarity and be brothers with all the different religious processes, but as we're discussing this verse, irreligion is taken as religion and religion is taken as irreligion, then any religious process which condones, for instance, the slaughterhouses, that cannot be religion. Because Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is Gopal. He's the protector of the cows, not Gohar, I guess you say, or Gohatyakari, the killer of cows. So this is irreligion. This is in the mode of ignorance. These activities of animal slaughter, wine drinking, these are activities in the mode of ignorance. Now, you're not saying that the Christian religion is wholly bad. I mean, definitely there are good things to be said. But if we examine that, where animal slaughter is allowed and where intoxication is allowed, that certainly cannot be true religion. And we should be very clear about this. Prabhupada, when he met Christians, he would always, first of all, he would be very strong on this point, that there cannot be any real religion as long as there is animal slaughter. And some of the Christians that Prabhupada spoke to, they accepted this. Prabhupada He was speaking at a Franciscan seminary. Seminary, you got that word? It means that they have that here also, the same word. Seminary, place where they train up monks and priests. So in Melbourne, in Australia. And they actually accepted what Prabhupada said. They agreed, yes, what you're saying is right. Because St. Francis is known as the... St. Francis of Assisi, the founder of their order, was known for his empathy for animals and even for plants. He, the brother, and you consider them all like his brothers. So Prabhupada is very pleased with that. But you can also see the... there's the video of Prabhupada speaking with Cardinal Daniello in Paris. Paris, where but Swamiji, the animals have no souls. And Prabhupada, he's just... Prabhupada, you see, is very angry with this man. He's the head of all the Catholics in France. Prabhupada is very angry. How can you say that? He was speaking in level terms, but you could... Prabhupada, how can you say they have no soul? And he would give the example that that we eat, the animals eat; we sleep, the animals sleep; we mate, the animals mate; we defend, the animals defend; we take birth, grow, have children, the animals do all these things. So how can you say there's any difference? There's no soul, but the intelligence, they don't have the same intelligence. And then the Prabhupada standards arguments that the children also don't have intelligence, so why don't you take them and eat them? So and then the cardinal said that, well, why don't we go into some higher topics? No, there's no higher topic. First you understand this topic. There's no question of understanding any higher topics. First you understand this topic. So this is mostly what goes on in the name of religion is irreligion. And also, although sometimes we may in some way identify the Krishna consciousness movement as a kind of Hinduism, it's also, at least philosophically, we should understand that we shouldn't propagate Krishna consciousness ultimately as Hinduism. Because Hinduism, that... it means so many... if we say Hinduism, that means that we're brothers with Sai Baba, for instance. And I've heard that some of our ISKCON devotees in Croatia have some sympathy for Sai Baba. But as far as I'm concerned, anyone who has any sympathy for Sai Baba cannot be a devotee of Krishna. Because the man is absolutely offensive to Krishna. So that's it. Well, maybe we did become Hindus, but anyway, I'm glad that Prabhupada saved me from being a Hindu or whatever else I might have been if I hadn't been taken in at his lotus feet. So it's not that we're promoting Hinduism over Christianity, because Hinduism itself, I mean, it's such a... as Prabhupada said, the modern Hinduism religion is a hodgepodge of concocted ideas going on under the influence of the Mayavad philosophy. So it's not that we're pro-Hindu and anti-Christian or any such thing, but we want to know what is the actual truth. Actual religion means that which is the ultimate truth. And everything which is not the ultimate truth means it's not the ultimate truth. It's not what is actual religion. It's not our actual... it's not Sanatan Dharma. Sanatan Dharma means the eternal position of the soul. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu defined that. Jiveshwarupoi Krishna Nityadas. So real religion means pure devotional service to Krishna. Nothing else. Even mixed devotional service. And that means mixed with material desires, mixed with material activities, mixed with mental speculation, that cannot be pure devotional service. That cannot fully satisfy Krishna. Now, and we bring with us various concepts. For instance, about religion, we have the idea that, well, Krishna consciousness is a kind of religion, and therefore we can, well, a kind of religion. So therefore, what we consider a religion should be, we tend to bring that into Krishna consciousness. There may be that tendency. Actually, it's said that one should come before a guru like a blank slate, that one should simply accept what he says. Sometimes it's said like that. Or one should pose as a fool before the spiritual master. So sometimes it's said like that. But then again, we see that blind following is not recommended, and that we see, for instance, that Arjuna, even though Krishna sometimes in the course of speaking Bhagavad Gita chastised Arjuna as a fool, but at the same time Arjuna was asking relevant questions based on his understanding. Actually, it was a misunderstanding. Arjuna's understanding of religion was a misunderstanding. He had his preconceptions, and Krishna sorted them all out and gave him the real understanding of religion. So no one is actually a fully blank slate. It would be nice if we came as a fully blank slate. Maybe and maybe not, because a fully blank slate, well, that means maybe there's nothing inside at all. So Krishna, God has given us some intelligence. So that should also be used to understand what is religion. Otherwise, the very good chance we're going to be cheated. If we go like a blank slate before someone who is not a bona fide representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then we'll get another kind of, we'll get trained up in another kind of irreligion. And it is again, ironic or unusual or noteworthy, we could say. I guess the word noteworthy. Noteworthy. It is something worth taking note of. It's a point could be made about it. That many people in the Western countries, they give up their Christian religion and they take up some kind of Eastern mysticism or some blend of Eastern mysticism and modern pop psychology or something like this, like New Age religion, something like that. They give up one kind of irreligion to accept another kind of irreligion. They give up their Western formal Christianity and go for something more, maybe avant-garde or whatever it is, or something different or Eastern or mystical or whatever they think it is. But it's, as the saying goes in English, it's out of the frying pan into the fire. You have something like that. You must have some similar saying in Croatian. If you're being fried in the pan, you might jump out, but then you just land in the fire. Your position is no better off. So going from one kind of adharma to another kind of adharma, even though it may be a more interesting or mystical or exciting or different adharma, but as one kind of adharmic or irreligious or bogus, famous bogus guru said, all paths lead to the same goal, which we reject because Krishna says something different. Ma me kam sharanam raja, surrender to me only. But actually what he says is correct in one sense. All paths except devotional service to Krishna lead to hell. Maybe indirectly. You know, there are different, you know, maybe long way, shorter way, deeper hell, less deep hell, but they all more or less go to the same place. And definitely we all end up mrityu samsara vartmani, back in the ocean of birth and death. If we don't get the actual truth, then we'll remain in the world of untruth, this material world. Therefore, it is essential to understand what is actual religion and what isn't. But as long as we are influenced by the mode of ignorance, as mentioned in this verse which I read today, tamasa avrita, covered by the mode of ignorance, then we not only can we not distinguish between religion and irreligion, but our whole sarvatan viparitangs cha, our whole understanding is back to front, so that we take irreligion to be actual religion, and what, when we see actual religion, we consider that to be irreligion. Completely twisted and perverted understanding. Now, I was saying that we come to Krishna consciousness with some preconceptions. We may have a preconception of what a religion is, that, well, everyone's nice to each other and we feed the poor or something like that. Or we may think, well, Krishna consciousness is some kind of mysticism. So that often happens when new people, I don't know about now, often people come to Krishna consciousness and they sit down with their eyes like this and they're expecting some kind of visions. That's recorded in Prabhupada Lilamrita, that one person, is it in Lilamrita? Anyway, someone in around 1967, Prabhupada preaching among the hippies, one of the hippies said that, well, when I chant Hare Krishna, I see a red light within my mind. And Prabhupada said, just go on chanting and it will go away. So he was thinking, this is something wonderful. And it was described, those hippies, they used to come and they were regularly taking LSD and they'd chant Hare Krishna, and then they'd like check, what's it doing to me, you know? Is it like some kind of LSD trip, or what does it do to you? So they had their preconceptions that it's a kind of mystic religion. And often people, even in India, you see people who are supposed to be devotees, they have some kind of mystic misunderstandings. That there was in the Hyderabad Pandal, that was about 1976. So at the end of Prabhupada's lecture, Prabhupada was taking questions, and one lady, middle-aged lady, got up with her son and said, he spoke in the mic and said, Swamiji, this morning we heard the tinkling of Krishna's ankle bells. And she went on and described a little, and Prabhupada listened. And then at the end, Prabhupada said very forcefully, you cannot see Krishna as long as you are materially contaminated. So Prabhupada rejected all this. So many misconceptions of religion. It's actually not religion at all. It's irreligion. Similarly, one devotee came from France once to Prabhupada and said that, you know, some of the devotees in our temple, they're visited by beings from another dimension, and not everyone can see them, but some of them are seeing, and they talk to them and they tell them, you see, this is going to happen in the world in future, and you have to be careful, and what you're doing is very good. And Prabhupada rejected this. He said, this is totally bogus. This is in the Conversations book. Prabhupada said that, how is it that he can see and others cannot see? This was Prabhupada's. And Prabhupada said, as far as I am concerned, he said, I never had such mystic apparitions. Maybe you have, you're something greater than me, that's being implied. But Prabhupada said, as far as I am concerned, Prabhupada said, when I examine among all my God brothers, there were so many who had so much more association with our Guru Maharaj. Many of them were sannyasis throughout their lives, where I was considered a rotten householder. They used to call pachagrihasta, rotten grihasta. And they were so austere, and I'm not very austere, Prabhupada said. Actually, one of Prabhupada's disciples, an elderly lady now, she invited me to lunch once. She lives in Bombay. And she told me that, she said, very simple lady, she said, you know, our Prabhupada, he liked to eat nicely. So she used to feed him. So he liked to eat nicely. So Prabhupada said, I'm not very austere, you see, I like to eat nice food and all this. So when I see among my God brothers, what is my qualification? My God brothers, they're so much scholarly, they may be. What is my qualification among them all? And Prabhupada said, as far as I am concerned, I can see the only qualification by which this wonderful thing has happened to me, that I was able to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, is that among all my God brothers, I was the only one who had full faith in the words of my Guru Maharaj. And he had the devotees repeat that Guru Mokavat Padmavakya. What does this mean? Chitete Koriya Aika. What does this mean? What does it mean? Who can say? Guru Mokka Padmavakya. What does this mean? Prabhupada was asking his disciples in this conversation, so I'm just asking you. Guru means Guru. What does that mean? Well, that's a good question. We should understand. Mukha, mouth, Padma, lotus, Vakya, words. So the words coming from the lotus mouth of the spiritual master. Chitete, within the heart. Chitete, Koriya Aikya, I make them one with my heart. Arna Koriho Manayasha, I don't desire anything else. So Prabhupada said, this is the formula for success. So he rejected this kind of mysticism. And so we may have different mystical ideas, or we may have some Christian ideas. Religion means, well, we do good to others, we're nice to others. And just like people think in the modern age, there is no greater saint than, what do the people in general think? Mother Teresa. She did such wonderful work among the poor and downtrodden in Calcutta. Just, she had homes for dying people. Her people would go out on the streets of Calcutta and they'd find people who were dying, and they'd take her to their home. Because many people in Calcutta, they live on the street. Just like some of you might be living here under the trees. So there are many people. If you go early morning chanting japa in the streets of Calcutta, you'll find many people sprawled out all over what passes as a pavement. And even on the roads, and in the middle of the road, sometimes they have this. On the really fancy roads, you'll find there's in the middle of the road, there's like an island with a little grass. Not grass in Calcutta, but anyway, some. And people sleep there. And anywhere, if there's any space at night, which it'll get occupied, under the stairs in some apartment building, if there's no one to throw them out, eventually they'll move their whole family in there. For sewage pipes, they put like this. When they bring them in, and then immediately someone comes and they live in it. The family comes, and then they put the politicians, because they want to get their votes, they come and they put a number on it, and they get an address. Anyway, people live on the streets. No need to talk so much about that. It's a little bit of prajalpur, actually. So she would send her workers out at night to find the people who are dying on the streets. And they'd take them to her home. And they'd die there. So all their life, they've been living on the street. And then the great gift, they can die in her home. And if they get better, out on the street again. And she had homes for lepers and all this kind of thing. So, and she was supposed to be helping the poor. But I tell you one thing. For all her great efforts in helping the poor, there's still a lot of poor people in Calcutta. A lot more than she could ever help. And then what is the help anyway? Because the people she helps, they still have to suffer repeated birth and death. So people think she's a great saint and she talks about compassion and I just want to help people in the name of Jesus. But it's not actually helping them very much. People get what's coming to them according to their karma. People think this is a very heartless philosophy. People get what is coming to them according to their karma. This was reported in Back to Godhead a few years ago, that the manager of the England football team got thrown out because some reporter found out that he believed in karma. And then so the reporter very cleverly asked him that, well, do you believe that, like, you know, physically challenged people, physical problem. Actually, the original word was spastic. Spastic means, maybe they have a leg missing or their leg is all mangled up and they walk on crutches. The original word was spastic. But then that became like a pejorative term. And people, you're spastic, someone would say as an insult. You know, like saying you dog, something like that, as an insult. So then they changed it to physically handicapped. And then that became a bad term. Now the latest term, I believe, is physically challenged. So then this newspaper reporter asked the manager of the England football team. It's like, it's a very prominent position, in very important position in society, in Karmi society. Definitely is. As far as they're concerned, you're always there interviewing you on TV. And, well, what do you think? And what do you think are our prospects? And, this thing. And who's he going to play? And he's a nationally famous figure. People, his face is known. If he walks in the street, he's always on TV. A very important person. So they asked him, this reporter who wanted to get a good story, asked him, well, do you believe that spastics, that it's due to their karma, they did something bad in their previous life and therefore they have to suffer? He said, yes. And that was it. He got it. And then he put it on he made a big report and it was a big story and there was a big outcry. How can you say that they're bad? It's just their bad luck. And how can you blame them? They're already suffering. They don't have legs which are working properly. How can you blame them? It's very bad. And he was thrown out from the England football team, from the job, because he believed in karma. So, like this, the idea of compassion, that you should always be nice to people and don't say anything to agitate them, and don't blame anyone, and it's not your fault. Don't worry, it's not your fault. That's a very important line, at least in English culture, that you placate someone if something goes wrong. Don't worry, it's not your fault. But according to the understanding of Bhagavad Gita, it is your fault. And it's all of our fault that we're all here in the material world. So this idea of compassion, it's very much misplaced. Prabhupada gave the example of, he gave an example from his life that when he was a householder in Calcutta, he heard in the next house the mother shouting, and then her son crying, and what's going on? So they have their underground network, that he had his servant go and ask the servant in the next house what's going on, and then the news came back. You see, this is, and they found out that the boy who was crying, his brother, that means another son of the mother, what happened was one of the sons had typhoid. Now in typhoid, heavy food is contraindicated. You shouldn't eat it. It's very dangerous. So you're not supposed to eat it. It's very dangerous. Your fever could increase and you could just die. Typhoid's dangerous disease. Krishna's mercy. I didn't get it so far. But it's a very heavy and nasty illness. So this boy had it, and in the house they were cooking parathas. You ever had parathas? You know what parathas are? It's like something like a chapati, but it's, the dough is mixed with some ghee, which makes it more tasty. And then it's, instead of being fried on a dry plate, it's fried in ghee. And you turn it over and fry again in ghee, so it's very tasty. And when it's being cooked, you can smell. So this boy had been practically starved because he had typhoid, he had the fever. So he asked his brother, can you just steal me a little bit of paratha and bring it to me? So his brother, he did it. His mother found out and she beat him and shouted, and the boy was crying, ah! So Prabhupada gave this example that he was helping his brother. It was out of a sense of compassion. He went, my brother's so hungry, let me do something to help him. But his help, it appeared to be help, but it wasn't actually help. And as a result, he got punished. And Prabhupada, because he's tattvavit. He knows philosophy, he knows the truth, he sees the truth. Therefore, he related this instance to our whole position in this material world, especially in the matter of one person trying to help another. If you try to help someone and they become pleased, oh, he's helping me, and others think, oh, that's very good, he's helping someone else. But if we don't know what is actually helpful to them, what is helpful is not necessarily that which satisfies their senses. We have to do something which is actually helpful in the ultimate way. And if we don't help them in the ultimate way, then that for their ultimate benefit, then we are not helping them, we are misdirecting them and making them making their condition worse. So that help is not help, and as a result you get punished by your mother, Mother Nature. So we say Mother Nature, the demons, they like to worship Mother Durga, but she punishes them. She has 10 hands and they all have weapons in, and they're for punishing the demons. You'll see the picture of Mother Durga. There's the Asura is standing before, very afraid of her because she's very severe in her punishment. So a misdirected, a misunderstanding of compassion. This Mother Teresa is considered to be very compassionate and very saintly, but she couldn't actually help anyone. And if she's feeding them meat and so many things, or encouraging them to become Christians, in which they'll eat meat, although most Bengali Hindus, pretty much all of them actually, they eat flesh anyway. So that leads me to another anecdote I can recall from days in Bangladesh. We were going around showing our movie of devotees all over the world, and we are evidence that it's, you know, it's true. There are devotees in the Western world. Here we are. We're not Bangladeshis painted white. We are genuine specimens of Westerners, and we're chanting Hare Krishna. So one Hindu social leader came to see us and said that, well, you're doing a very great job, because you see, before you started to do this, all the Hindus were becoming converted to Christians and Muslims, mostly Christians. So you're doing a very good job. You're stopping this conversion to Christianity. So then he said, well, what's the actual benefit, you know? We see here in Bangladesh that Christians eat flesh and the Hindus eat flesh. So what's the benefit? And we went on for some time discussing. And then he finally came up with, well, if they're Hindus, they're more inclined, and they will always say, at least in Bangladesh, they'll always say the name of Gauranga, whereas the Christians won't, because the Bangladeshi Hindus, they're Vaishnavs of sorts. They chant the name of Gauranga, but they also tend to eat fish. Now after more than 20 years of ISKCON's preaching, there quite a lot of them have stopped eating fish, but because they know what's right and what's wrong. But at that time, Hindu pretty much meant a Hindu, Christian, Muslim, they all ate flesh if they could afford it. So we accepted that, but intrinsically, you see, if one is eating flesh, and then where is the religion actually? If especially this slaughterhouse, that's killing of animals wholesale, and eating fish, Manu Samhita states that the fish eats everything. The fish eats all stool and all kinds of things. That's why you'll find where this in towns where the sewage comes out into the sea, you'll find so many fish thriving if the water's not polluted otherwise, because they like to eat the stool. And then people catch the fish and eat it. So if you're eating a fish, you're eating everything processed. So what is actually religion and what is irreligion? Many people misunderstood Prabhupada, that why is a saintly person, he's always speaking so strongly and using such strong words. And Prabhupada would say, I'm simply repeating what Krishna says. Krishna's God, he has the right to say that, and it is my duty to repeat that. So To actually understand what religion is, we have to understand from what Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita, from Srimad Bhagavatam, from what our Vaishnav Acharyas say. Because otherwise the tendency is just like you see, I see many of these T-shirts, do not eat my friend, like this. And there's a picture of a boy embracing a cow. Which, that's nice. Or, be vegetarian. But that in itself does not constitute religion. As Prabhupada would often point out, even the pigeons and monkeys are vegetarian. There's no great credit to be a vegetarian. Sometimes we think, well, being vegetarian is very good. But that is maybe compared to the modern state of human society, it is. But actually from the point of view of civilized human society, vegetarianism is just a natural prerequisite. That's all. It's just a minimum standard. So often people in karmic society, they appreciate, oh, you're vegetarian, very good. And it's easy for us to get appreciation on that level among certain people. Oh yes, vegetarian. So then we start to preach, you know, like Krishna consciousness, like the main thing is vegetarianism, because we know many people will appreciate that. But we have to be careful that we don't ourselves come down to the mundane platform of thinking that, well, vegetarianism is all in all. And that's the main point, and we'll just introduce vegetarianism and maybe ask people to chant Hare Krishna a little bit. But then ourselves, we become more concerned. We go to vegetarian meetings and we preach about vegetarianism and we tend to lose our focus. Or just like Prabhupada wanted widespread prasadam distribution. So we find that if we distribute food among poor people, the people in general think, well, this is wonderful, this is very good. And so we do that, and people give donations, and we distribute food to poor people, and then we advertise how we're helping people to, these people are hungry, and we're feeding them. And although we may be feeding them prasadam, we are presenting Krishna consciousness as a kind of, the main point of Krishna consciousness is to feed people who don't have enough to eat. And actually most people have enough to eat, and the poor people, they have enough to eat, and if we feed them, they spend it on booze. Usually that's what happens. But people think, well, this is a booze, you know this word? It means alcohol. And not, sorry, it's English slang. And when I'm talking about alcohol, we're not talking about this cassette head cleaner, not that alcohol. We're talking about this alcohol. So, but it's an easy platform to present that, you see, we're helping people and people sympathize. Yes, it's a very good thing you're doing. And the tendency is that we ourselves start to think that, yes, we're doing a very good thing, we're helping the poor people and we're feeding them. But we should understand that without giving Krishna consciousness, then simply filling the belly is, it has no particular meaning. And if we present that it's poor feeding, only to feed the poor, without presenting, well, actually the less poor people, they're also poor, because they don't have Krishna consciousness. So we should be careful. I mean, it's not that I'm against prasad distribution or preaching among vegetarians or any such thing. But we should be careful not to fall within their stereotypes. We have to present that Krishna consciousness is much more than simply vegetarianism. It's much more than simply feeding the poor. It's much more than anyone without Krishna consciousness. It's much more than any concept they have of religion. So there's much more to be said about this, but I don't have much time, so I'll finish there. If there are any questions, I could take one or two. Please.
But I would like
a lot
to
of things sound strange.
Yeah.
I'm used to it.
we have heard a lot about the regulative principles, mm. and we know that it's very impractical to break them and lead spiritual
practical
life.
Impractical.
To be spiritualist and break the rules. But I would like to know, is it technically sin? And if it is, why is it technically sin to break each of the rules? And why should breaking of the rules we follow as devotees make one,
impede one's spiritual advancement?
No, but act technically as a sin and degrade one to hellish existence in the in the next life or whatever.
But what's the question? Actually, I couldn't follow it.
We know that for spiritual existence, for spiritual life is for certain...
Four regulated principles are essential.
Yes. But is it technically a sin, for example, to gamble?
Or yes.
And
Yatra papas chatur vidham. What is it? Striya sunna. That's mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's just striya means illicit sex, sunna means drinking, and as usual, I can only remember part of the verse because I only have part of a brain. But then it says yatra papas chaturvidham. This means Kali, the personality of Kali, was allowed to reside in these four places where there is illicit sex, meat eating, gambling, and intoxication. And where are these four kinds of papa sin? It's specifically mentioned. I'm still trying to remember, but I always remember after the class. Anyway, I can get away with it in Croatia. In India, it's not so. Doesn't look so good. Yes, according to Shastra, it is sinful. It's not just something that Prabhupada dreamed up. It's very firmly based on Shastra. Why is gambling a sin? Well, there are four principles of religion, namely truthfulness, mercy, austerity, and cleanliness. So these four kinds of irreligion, they destroy mercy, truthfulness, cleanliness, and austerity. How they do so, it's sometimes described a little differently in each way. Just like animal slaughter destroys mercy, and gambling destroys truthfulness, intoxication destroys austerity, and which one did I miss? Gambling destroys truthfulness. Yeah, I already said it. Then illicit sex. Cleanliness, yeah. So sometimes it's described like, but anyway, the general idea is that it destroys the necessary the qualities which are necessary to advance in spiritual life. This is all described in very clearly in the first canto of Bhagavatam, where it's described how Maharaj Parikshit, he gave Kali, the personality of Kali, this the places to reside where there is... first of all, he wanted to give that, and then he said, well, there is no place in your kingdom. He said, well, you can go where there is gold. Where there is gold. Did you read the Prabhupada's first canto Bhagavatam? Read it again and again. And all of it. There's a lot there. It's an encyclopedia of spiritual knowledge, so we may not grasp it all first time round. You have to read it a few times and then go on and read some more. Yes. Ah, yes, this is another interesting discussion. What does it mean by unclean? That's a big topic. Unclean, in the Western countries, we the idea of clean is when everything looks clean. But according to Vedic understanding, one can look clean and not be clean. And even one can look unclean and be clean. Just like, for instance, It's quite common in the West that people pass stool, wipe their backside with a piece of paper, and come out, and their clothing is clean, and they have some, you know, something on their face, some powder or something, and they look clean. Whereas you'll find some people in India, they go and bathe in the river, and they put their dhoti on again, and it looks a little grey, because they just, every time they bathe, they put their dhoti in the river, and the water, especially if you use Ganga water, is a little muddy. So it actually may become a little more muddy looking rather than cleaner by washing in the Ganga. So their cloth looks dirty, but actually they're clean because they took a bath and their cloth has been washed in the Ganga. What is cleanliness? This is a big topic, very big topic. What is cleanliness? And there's external cleanliness, internal cleanliness. It's a big topic which I don't have time to get into now.
There's something considering the benefits we are receiving from the modern civilization. There are devotees who are preaching against the modern civilization. They are strongly criticizing it, but still they're always in the line to receive their monthly social help, or also they're depending on the state concerning the health insurance. So the question really is whether they should stop criticizing or speaking strongly against such a civilization if they're depending on it, or should they maybe, if they want to be truthful to their words, should they really abandon all the connections with it and live freely without any contact with the modern society?
Prabhupada had the revolutionary plan of leaving modern society, living on the land, producing our own food, and not having anything to do with money ultimately. That's the ultimate revolution. It doesn't look very good if a man is capable of working and he just lives off the state. It's a person who simply lives off others without contributing to human society. That's called a parasite, actually. So every person is expected to contribute to human society. Now, if we're preaching Krishna consciousness, then one may accept donations, or if one's a... But if one is not... But actually, just like our preachers of Krishna consciousness, if we're actually preaching, then we should have the faith that Krishna... If we're fully preaching, then we should have the faith that Krishna will look after, and He will. It certainly doesn't look very good if our devotees, they have no intent, they don't work, and they just accept money. And of course, it may be that someone has the intention to work, and then but he can't find work for some time, and then he takes some social security. But as a way of living throughout one's life, it's not very laudable. That's a general comment, but we'd have to see in individual cases what the actual situation is. Okay, I guess my time's up. I can just do my book, Kanige Reklama, something like that. Reklama Kanige, okay.